둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Okay, there we go.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you, as always, for making your way here, for checking out the series. Hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that we put out every single week. We get three every week, new and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can grab us anywhere you get your podcasts from, including Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. I do also appreciate it when you leave reviews, give ratings. Those always help out a ton. We've had some fantastic guests on the show lately, including the cast of Shrinking, playing now the second season on Apple TV+, Depeche Mode, Jerry Cantrell of Alice in Chains, Les Claypool, and Maynard James Keenan were here together for the 1,000th episode of Kyle Meredith With. We had Big Sean, Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac, Julia Stiles, and Thomas Lennon, both starring in Chosen Family with Heather Graham, Colin Greenwood of Radiohead, The Offspring, Brian Ferry of Roxy Music, the cast of It's What's Inside, Mastodon's Troy Sanders, just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith, today catching up with Black Francis, a.k.a. Frank Black, a.k.a. Charles Thompson, lead singer of the Pixies. They are back with an album called The Night the Zombies Came, which we get to talk all about. He'll reflect on the shifting landscape of music since the rise of streaming, noting how it's transformed the industry, especially elevating live performances to the primary importance while diminishing the commercial impact of recorded music. Now, if that makes it sound like it's dire, it's actually given him freedom to make the albums that he wants to make, and even more often. So we're going to hear about all of that. We're also going to head back in time to 1994 for the 30th anniversary of his solo album, Teenager of the Year. Its creation, the chaotic but exhilarating process like that happened around the recordings with fires in Los Angeles, the spontaneous sessions, really to what ended up being one of the coolest albums and a discography that's completely full of very cool albums. Let's get into this to talk about zombies and rock operas and a drunk Eric Idle as we dig into The Night the Zombies Came. It's Kyle Meredith with Black Francis of the Pixies.
Nice to see you again.
You guys got this fantastic new record, though, with the Night the Zombies Came, which, I don't know, you've been on a roll. I don't know if you call it banging them out lately, but it feels like you're kind of, I don't know, what is this? You know, you have consistently released great music throughout your career, but is there something that you feel like has been different these past few years?
I guess the one thing that's different now is that because of the advent of streaming music, and streaming music has made it, I don't know if it's the sole reason why, I guess you could say the advent of the internet and then streaming has kind of turned the record business upside down. And what has happened as a result of that is that everyone says it's so different now, but I would disagree and just say, no, just the mountains and the valleys have kind of shifted their position. You know what I mean? And so what has happened is it's made the live, it's made a personal appearances, right, have a certain kind of value that I think they didn't, there wasn't as much value on concerts before. I mean, they were very valuable, but what was also just as valuable was the recorded music reference, right? The records that people put out. And so people spend money on records, and then they also spend money on concert tickets. But now what has happened is that people spend way less money on records, and they still spend the same or more amount of money on the personal appearances. And so as a result of that paradigm, if you're established and you have a reputation and you have a name, the audience is much more willing to go and see, say, me versus someone who's brand new, right? Because they go, okay, I know what I'm getting involved in here, especially for so-called legacy acts who maybe charge a bit more money or a lot more money than a new act. You know, people have to want to spend the $50 or whatever it is that they're spending on a ticket to go see you. You know, they're very picky. You know, they're very picky. And that's why a lot of tours get canceled, because people aren't as interested in paying money to see someone that doesn't have, that isn't tried and true. You know, that's one reason. The other reason is that sometimes artists spend too much damn money on stupid shit and they can't afford to go touring. You know what I mean? That's why. Mm-hmm. Another reason why. Also because of the pandemic, you know, things cost more, so it's more expensive to go touring. But basically, the live personal appearance has become kind of the most important thing. And the good news about that scenario is that, I suppose, is that in a way to remain relevant and not just an oldies kind of a performer, you put out new music. You have an opportunity. People don't question it. They don't question it. It's like, hey, so-and-so put out a record and it wasn't a hit. They don't go, oh, it was a big failure. You only, you know, because no one's really selling that many records anyway. So it's really just seen as a sign that you're still alive, that you still got some brain cells left, that you still have an ability to do what you've always done, right? It's a kind of a validation. Oh, they put out a record, so I only like their old stuff, but they're still doing it. And if I go see them perform live, they're probably going to do some of their old stuff. I'm in, right? So that's how it is from the audience point of view. From my point of view, it means that I can put out records without a lot of stress around it. There used to be so much more stress around releasing a record when I was young. When I was young, it was like, oh, are they going to get dropped by the label? Ooh, how many did they do out of the box? Where are they in the charts? You know, what are they saying? What's the word of the street? I don't know how many records I haven't known how many records I've sold for like literally 15 years. I have no idea. I don't have a clue how many records I sell. I did hear eventually, if we do pretty good, I'll hear from the manager, hey, you guys done pretty good, whatever. You know, you sold X. You sold way more than all these people over here. You're still in. So I don't worry about that anymore. Now I can just make music kind of not quite at my leisure, but almost at my leisure. You know what I mean? Yes, I have to go do interviews and I got to go on tour, but I always had to do that. So that's not anything different. But that's how I stay in the game, is to go and make new records. So That's my favorite part of it anyway. I like performing a lot. I love it. But I love recording the records even more. You know, so as long as I get to do a record every year or two, I'm great. I would do a record every 6 months if I could. But I don't push it, you know. So I'm happy to do records on a regular basis. And I don't feel, I've never felt compromised. I always do whatever the hell I want to do, but I don't feel quite the kind of annoying pressure of the record company or somebody going, oh, can you make it a little more like this or make it a little more like that? It's like, now there's none of that concern in the air. You know, it's just sort of like, yeah, do whatever you do. When are you when's let us know when the record's coming out so we can book your tour.
And we'll be right back right after this.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Black Francis of Pixies.
I would be okay with you putting a record out every 6 months to begin with, but that's just a greedy fan sort of thing for me to say. I love that you even use the words alive and brain cells as we're talking about a record called The Night the Zombies Came. I just wanted to kind of pluck that out of there because that seemed just too perfect not to, that you're doing that. But I want to pick up on that too, because you said this is not a concept record by any means, but at the same time, you know, as you talk about, for as long as you all have been making the music, as you were just referencing right there, and what you've written about in the past and maybe some fan expectations. I mean, even in the last few records, you know, I'm thinking of like Graveyard Hill and Haunted House and things like that. And you got the zombies. I mean, what's keeping you from doing that, from making that concept album? You've done books, which, by the way, still one of my favorite things I've ever had. I still love Crack of This Open. You know, what is keeping you from going that extra step like that?
No one asks me. Well, let me see. What is, I guess I like the idea of a rock opera, but I don't know that anyone successfully pulled that off, because basically your average pop music fan doesn't go to the opera. I've never been to the opera. I think I understand what it's all about. I used to take singing lessons from an opera singer, but I'm not an opera person, you know. But yet we have two things going on. We have the concept of the LP, the long play record, which started, I believe, in 1948 with the release of several singles and EPs compiled for the artist Frank Sinatra. And Columbia Records or CBS, whoever, Columbia, I guess, put out the first sort of pop LP. And ever since then, we've had LPs. Now, streaming destroyed the concept of the LP. You would have thought that it would have, because we don't even buy that many records anymore. However, even people that are young, that have grown up not really touching these LPs, these physical versions of the record, there's still this kind of romantic notion around the idea of an LP. It's like a picture into the artist's life in the season. What was going on in that season? What was going on in your life, you know, around when you were making that album, you know? Who was there? Who was playing on it? Were you guys fighting? Were you partying? Were you going under a religious conversion? What was going on, you know? There's this whole notion of, oh, that's the song when he was going through his, that's his divorce album, right? Well, that's the album where he was on smack, you know what I mean? There's all of these, we understand that concept of a season. And the LP really represents a season, I think. And even though people don't buy records like that for the most part anymore. We consume them streaming, and we listen to things in piecemeal. It's still this notion of the LP, I think, is very much alive. You can't really get rid of it for whatever the reason. I don't know what the reason is, but that's the way that I see it. And so what was my point? Here's my point. That's part one. Part two of my point is some of us who are all of us understand the idea of a concept album or call it a rock opera, your Quadrophenias, you know, whatever. That's cool. Everyone understands that concept, but it's very rare. Like you'll have some artist, I'm going to do a new album and it's called the blah, blah, blah. And it's just, story, and it's, you know, we want to like elevate the LP to like a novel or to a great cinema presentation, right? We really want in our hearts to elevate it to that, but much like the music video, it doesn't quite get there. We wanted to make the video its own art form, right? It didn't work out that way, did it? It just has never. People still make them. People have been doing them since they put out records, but it's never really. Oh, that's not the new art form. Oh, what's your favorite rock opera? People can't even tell you what the one rock opera is about. You know what I mean? They don't really know. The way that we relate to rock and roll music or pop music is it's like they're 3-minute pop songs. It's got a beginning and a middle and an end. You know, verse, chorus, and end, right? That is how we consume music, but yet we still love an LP, and I think we still love the idea of unifying concepts, unifying themes, your rock opera. So what happens when I make records, I've noticed with Pixies, especially in recent years, is sometimes there'll be a word or a phrase or a notion that enters the room at some point. In this case, it's sort of like zombie or whatever, zombie movie or something like that. I don't remember when that first came up, but as soon as something like that comes up in a very sort of not very serious way, I'll say to the producer, are you paying attention here? There's a zombie in the room because he's sitting right over there in the chair. Let's not make too big a deal out of it. We don't need to like talk to him. We don't need to address it, but that's what's in the room now. That's what's in the room. And so the next time the notion comes up in the next song or whatever, it's not going to be every song. It's not going to always be a specific reference that you can go, there's zombie again. Sometimes it is, sometimes it is. It's real loose, but there's an idea that's around. And then as soon as you acknowledge it, suddenly that idea lingers and it's around more. And the more that you're open to it, the more it shows up and the less you question it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, whatever. There's been a lot of zombie stuff in popular culture the last 20 years, just like vampires. Hey, you want to, is there a metaphor going on there? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. We did have a global fucking pandemic a few years ago, so we could start there, right? You know, I don't even need to go any further than that. It's like, I don't need to explain why or maybe zombie is an appropriate metaphor for an LP in the year 2024. But, you know, all one has to do is look at the history books and go, oh, well, the world is still reeling from this global pandemic. So there's something in the air. You know what I mean? There's some kind of thing that we're just like when I'm making a record, everyone knows there's a zombie in the room. You know what I mean? Whatever you want that to mean. Whether you want it to be literal or spiritual or emotional or political or whatever, it's there. Once it's there, you why get rid of it? It's a psychological whip that's kind of moving you along. You know what I mean? Going, don't forget about me. I'm right here. Don't kick me out. You know what I mean? It's like, it's part of, it becomes part of the artistic process, you know? And so, and to me, it's much more interesting or legitimate than saying, let's have a concept album by a guy named Jimmy. And Jimmy, like, blah, 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 blah. On we go. It's exhausting, right? It's exhausting. But if I just go, yeah, there's something in the air, you know? And that's going to inform a lot of things. And I think that is where you want, I think that's where you want rock music to be. That's where you want songs to be. You want them to be open-ended somewhat. You don't, I mean, look, unless you're like a prog rock band and you're doing, you know, if it's a Marillion album about, like, you know, some elf colony or something, you know, nothing against Marillion or whoever. I'm not dissing them. I'm just saying, I get it. There's some people that take that to the next level, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. That's not what I'm doing here. I think if you look at, say, the songwriting of, say, Neil Young is a good example, you know, where there's a lot of universality in his lyrics, and there's a lot of stuff that's not on the nose, you know what I mean? And it's kind of a little bit open-ended, and it kind of allows you to interpret the music as you, just like looking at a painting. It's like, how much do we want to dictate here, and how much do we want to, like, leave it open so that the listener can kind of develop their own relationship with it, right? And that's psychologically also a lot more interesting. It's a lot more interesting, like when I would go to a therapy, right? You're telling the story, you're telling the therapist one story, right? And you think, oh, I know what they want to hear this week. They want to talk about blah, 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 and I got it all up here. I'm going to tell them all about this and blah, 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 blah. And you tell them the thing, and then what the fuck they do? They go, whoa, 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 stop. That little thing you said 5 minutes ago, that little funny expression or that little word, or what's that all about? And then you're like down a totally different rabbit hole. It's psychologically way more interesting. You know what I mean? So I think for me to be open-ended and to be kind of a little bit loose with the concepts and the notions is good for, it's good. It's good for the rock. It's good, I think.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Black Francis of Pixies.
One thing I love about all that, and something I've always wondered about your writing specifically in Pixies, like I was talking to my wife yesterday about this record. We were kind of discussing, you know, when I was researching the interview and all that stuff. and we were talking about the song, and she brought up something about getting into the meaning of the lyrics. And I said, you know, for Pixies, for me, I love the lyrics. Most of the time, I don't know what you're talking about as you're getting at, that it's almost more about mood. Like, I like the mood that you produce. It might have been in the press release with Motorola, one of the new songs on the record, where you said you're just fishing around for lyrics. Doesn't matter if I know what's going on. There's a Berlin adventure happening, you know, but that's what I love. Like, when you said, you know, way back then, you're slicing up eyeballs, and I'm like, the fuck is that about? I don't care. That's fun to say. It's fun to sing. And my God, I love the mood of this. Like, for you as the writer, how important is it for me to understand what you're talking about versus just to have this, you know, blanket envelop me with whatever the song is in totality?
Yeah, I mean, also, at least for a band like the Pixies, you know, we have an international audience. A lot of our audience doesn't even speak English, and they're responding to the music. They like it or whatever. I don't know. When I listen to, I'm a big fan of the Italian songwriter, Paolo Conte. And I don't speak Italian. I have no fucking idea what Paolo is on about. But I suspect, just by the mood that he's created with the music, I suspect he's probably a pretty good lyricist. You know what I mean? I can just tell. You can just tell in the choices that he's making with the words, even though I don't understand them, probably put some thought into it or some spirit or whatever it is that drives him. It's not just, you know, he didn't just fart it out or whatever. It's good. And so I had to take that into consideration. I don't have to, but I do now take that into consideration. But people in Paris, they don't know what the hell I'm on about.
But they can, if they want to, learn what that lyric's about. And suddenly there's a history lesson in a lot of your lyrics if you want to take that step.
Sure. If you wanted to sit down with the song Motorola, are you actually going to be able to figure out what the song was totally about? Probably not. But if you were to go through and pick up on all of the clues and try to like go down the rabbit hole a little bit with all of the clues, you're going to start to come up. Something is going to emerge. You're going to start to have a pretty good, you're going to get warmer to what it is. And sometimes what it is not a very specific answer. It's more of a, it's kind of like, well, look, first of all, I only got 2 or 3 minutes and I don't even have, I'm only on the mic for the verses and the choruses. And I got to make it rhyme. I have to repeat things. I don't have to, but a lot of times you repeat things, you know? Even though, like, when I'm writing a lot of music, it's like I'm looking through a keyhole into a big, giant ballroom, a whole universe of stuff, you know? And I have to I can't put everything that I see into one little song. It's too much. It's too much information there. I don't know. I can't decide what is the good information and what is the bad information. I can't necessarily tell you what is the most entertaining aspect of it. All I can do is say, well, I'm the shaman here, so I'm going to tell you what I see in the keyhole. Hold on. Here we go. Okay. So now when I'm writing the song, that's what I'm looking through the keyhole, right? I'm connecting the dots because I'm like, I'm on this, like, it's almost like a adrenalized, amphetamized, I'm not on amphetamines, but it's like, it's very, very, it's what I imagine amphetamines to be like. It's very, very rapid. And I'm jumping from place to place. And my mind is like connecting a lot of dots. And I'm kind of, and a lot of it might even be rationalizations. I might be like, oh, of course. I'm like, of course that is connected. Don't, oh my gosh, this is perfect. I can't believe everything is connected. This is perfect. And you go through that process and you finish the song. And then lo and behold, a week goes by, 2 weeks go by, 2 months go by, 2 years go by. The longer that time passes, the more time that passes, the less I am connected to that manic experience that I had when I wrote it. And so you ask me about songs from a long time ago, and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't remember. I sort of like, was it about, I don't know. If you ask me in the moment when I'm writing it, it's all very, very clear to me. You know what I mean? It's like I have the deciphering key that explains it all, why it all makes perfect sense. You know what I mean? And it's almost like a little bit of a crazy thing. It's like, no, it's like my own conspiracy theory. You know what I mean? It's like, no, you don't understand. It's all connected, right? But, and maybe it is and maybe it is, I don't know, but that's what it feels like. And so I've only got this 2 or 3 minute song to kind of squeeze in whatever I can, you know. The end result is that you end up with things that are abstracted out sometimes. And those tend to be sometimes the more interesting things. Not always, you know, hey, there's plenty of great songwriters out there that don't write like that. They're like, I need to write a song about this. And they write, they're very specific, and it's like they're writing a thesis or something, and it's very clear. And you read that lyric and you're like, oh my God, it's a song about this. Very, very clear. When I do that, I would say I get, at best, I get sort of esoteric or quirky results. At worst, I get sort of mediocre, kind of boring results. You know what I mean? And so I try as much as I can to get in this kind of poetic, manic kind of headspace when I'm writing music. When it gets too bogged down in the meaning and everything, nothing against people that write that way, but that's not what I'm that good at. You know what I mean? I would like to be, and sometimes, for God's sakes, I try to write some biographical song or a historical song or something like that. I try to make it so that it all makes sense, so that when you experience my song, when you get to the end of it, you're going to totally get it and understand. I still fall for that fucking trap from time to time. I still do it. But I got to say, if I were to judge myself, I probably don't get away with it as much as I would like to, you know? So I definitely go for a looser, open-ended, more poetic kind of thing, because that's where I'm comfortable. And it always has the more interesting result, you know? It's always more psychological. It's always way more psychological. I remember when I did my first solo record called Frank Black, CDs, they had put out, they were putting out all these box sets of artists, you know, on CD. That was the thing, remastered or bonus tracks and all that, right? And I got a copy of Pet Sounds, right? And I knew a lot of the songs on that record, but I never really had sat down and listened to the whole record from beginning to end. And then not only did I have the record, but I had this sort of box set version of it or whatever. This had all of this bonus stuff in it, right? And there was a song on there called I Know There's an Answer, but which I didn't really know that well or at all. But there was this other version of the song with a different lyric called Hang On to Your Ego. And when I heard that, I went, oh, that's psychologically, that's way more interesting to say hang on to your ego is way more interesting than I know there's an answer. You know what I mean? It's just like you can't even compare. You know what I mean? Nothing wrong with I know there's an answer, but hang on to your ego is fucking what the hell? That's, whoa, what's that all about? Hang on to, that's like, it's just got, it's way, it's darker and it's more mysterious and it feels almost more true. You know, it feels much more true to the human condition than something that's sort of like just a plaintive, hopeful statement or something. You know what I mean? I know there's an answer, you know? I mean, I get it. I know there's an answer. I could see myself writing a song like that, but hang on to your ego. It's like, it's almost haunting. You know what I mean? And so that was a good lesson for me at that point. I think it was probably my producer, Eric Feldman, who said when I went and did that version, he said, oh, that's way more interesting from a psychological point of view, way more interesting. Let's do that version as opposed to the original version. And so that was a good lesson. I was like, oh yeah, it's way more interesting, isn't it? And so I that was a good epiphany kind of a moment. And so I've always tried to steer things more into the psychological.
And I think I could pick out lyrics from, geez, any of these songs. You're So Impatient, Chicken, Primrose, I Hear You, Mary. I mean, the way you still pull those out of there. And I'm only kind of breezing through there because I only have a few minutes here. But since you brought up that, you've also got, I mean, we have this new Pixies record, but you're going to tour next year, the 30th anniversary of the Teenager of the Year album, which in itself, much like a lot of those Beach Boys songs and albums that, you know, you've referenced there, there was a record that sort of came out and made its little noise at the beginning and then kind of backed up and became something else over the years. I'm doing the thing that you said you have trouble doing when I'm asking you to revisit something, but what makes that record so special? I don't know how you feel about it, but what I would ask you is, why do you love this record?
Well, the one thing that I think that Eric and I can both agree on is that we really enjoyed making it. And at the time, we were interrupted by the earthquake, the Northridge earthquake. All our tapes got stuck in a vault because the vault was an electric vault, and the LA lost all the power. We were interrupted by brush fires in LA. We had to move studios because of the fires. We had to move studios because the other co-producer and engineer, Al Clay, he had to leave. He wanted the record to be done when we were about halfway through. And he was actually kind of mad at us because we, He's like, well, this is the version of the record I believe in, right? Of course, he believed in it because he had to leave and go work on his next record. But Eric and I were so, like, having such a good time, and we didn't care, you know? And the record company, it wasn't like we were spending millions of dollars on it, but we were definitely spending tens of thousands of dollars on it. And it wasn't like crazy. I think we ended up spending about 200 grand on the record. But for the time, that wasn't like that crazy. But, you know, at one point, you know, we asked them, look, the record could be done right now as planned, but we would like to continue and make it bigger. And they said yes. I don't know why they said yes. They could have said no and it would have been over, but they said yes. And so we kept spending the money and they said okay. And they believed in the artist, or they were distracted by other things. I don't know which it was, but we were able to continue working and continue having that fun and bouncing around between different studios. And I would just literally just show up with a new song every day and without lyrics or anything. And the guys I was playing with were what you call quick studies, right? So I'd be like, you know, they're like way better musicians than I am, but I was writing the music. So I was like, oh, here's another one. They were like, okay. And it was so much fun to get all this kind of results so quickly, you know, and we just, we had a blast making that record. And so, yeah, it's quirky and it's esoteric, but we really weren't crawling up our own ass. You know what I mean? It was not that kind of an atmosphere where it was so important and we were taking it really serious. It was more like, we could do whatever we want and no one seems to care. And this is fun. And this is what it must be like to be in the Beatles. And you know what I mean? We just like, it's so much fun. I remember we were working at, I think it was a studio that was owned by, what's his name there from the Eurythmics, Dave Stewart. He had this studio and the house that was in front of the studio that was just in the back, like in the carriage house or something. And the studio, that the house in the front, he wasn't living there, but he would rent it out to his famous friends or whatever who were making movies. Eric Idle was in there making a movie or something. So he would show up at the end of a day of shooting, just walk in the session drunk as a skunk, you know what I mean? Because he'd been filming all day and he just had his Heinekens, you know, and he'd show up blasted at the end of the day, kind of right when we were kind of getting going, you know. He would show up with his guitar and he would want us to change a guitar string or something for him, you know. He just wanted to hang out because he just wanted to be around a recording session. And so that was really fun for us. It was like, hey, we got Eric Idle here, you know, changing Eric's strings for him, you know, and oh, Jeff Flynn's out there playing tennis, the Kenneth Torts today, you know. And I remember we were working in another studio with Sergio Mendes, you know, Sergio Mendes, mm-hmm. Brazil 66, yep. Right? Mm-hmm. We had just seen Sergio perform with Brazil 99. Right in Las Vegas, because all the power, I told you that the record got shut down because of the earthquake. We went to Vegas for a few days. Eric and my wife and I, we all went to Vegas to take a shower because we had none of us had water or anything like that or toilets that worked. We're like, let's go to fucking Vegas for a week and get out of LA. And we can't work on the record anyway. So we would go there and we went to shows. And I remember we saw Sergio Mendes and he was great. And, we went back to LA and we ended up working at a studio that we heard he actually owned the studio, and it was up in the hills of Calabasas, you know, and there was this huge fire raging like about a mile down the road, and they hadn't evacuated the neighborhood yet, but we had the studio. It was all black on the inside, you know, like all cloth, black cloth and black furniture. Everything was black. And we found out after a couple of days that we were exhausted because we couldn't turn on enough lights and it just kept absorbing all the light. And we just were like, it's so tiring. It must be because everything is black in here. So they had all these big, huge, widescreen TVs in the studio control room. So we just put it on the fires that were raging down the street on the news, you know, because they kept, you know, they kept evacuating certain neighborhoods. And we were like, shit, we're going to have to evacuate here pretty soon. And but every day we'd be like, are we good to go? And the studio manager would be like, yeah, you're still good. No evacuations yet. And the fire, we eventually did have to evacuate. And then, but we just kept pushing it and pushing it. The fire we had, so all the TV screens were just like blazes of flames going around. And we're like doing vocals like from my Cadillac over like a CB radio and stuff. And just, it was just kind of kooky and fun and experimental and not at all serious. Just like life is crazy and it's all, the world's going to California's falling into the ocean or whatever the hell's going on here. But we're making a record and we're not going to stop until we're done having fun. And that's what we did. And then eventually it was like, it was finally, we were exhausted and we were done and we couldn't do anymore. And we said, okay, it's done. Record's done. And we didn't know what people would think about it. You know, I didn't presume that I made the greatest record that ever was made. I didn't presume that it was Sgt. Pepper's, you know, I didn't presume that it was Quadrophenia. I just went, whatever. We made a record. We had a great time. And whatever, man, what are they going to do? Sue us. If you don't like it, fucking sue us. We don't care. And it was just the kind of, that was the atmosphere making that record. And it was awesome. You know what I mean? It was just like, it was a blast. I don't think I've had as much fun making a record since then. It was great.
I love even the line right now, I want to live on an abstract plane, just makes a lot more sense to me. And by the way, talking about things in the air, yesterday I was doing an interview with Les Claypool and Maynard Keenan, and Les was just hanging out with Eric Idle and Weird Al and some other folks. And it's like, that's twice in 2 days that Eric Idle has ended up in one of these. And I don't think I've talked about Eric Idle in 6 years before this. So whatever that is anyway, but really, seriously, congrats on the new record with The Night the Zombies Came. I'm looking forward to some of these solo shows as well. And my God, it has been so much fun to talk to you today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks. Good to see you again. Take care.
My thanks to Charles. The new Pixies album is called The Night the Zombies Came and the 30th anniversary of Teenager of the Year. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button if you're not already before you get out of here. New interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 3 a week at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With, and don't forget to give the series a rating, leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Van Morrison, Solomon Burke, Billie Holiday, Galliano, Letters to Cleo, Pavement, The Clash, Richie Havens, Logic 1000, The Shins, Chance the Rapper, Death Cab for Cutie, Jason Isbell, Sting, Bjork, De La Soul, Clipping, Danny Elfman, U2, and my interview with comedian musician John Early to talk about his latest special, Now More Than Ever, playing on Max and on vinyl. Just an example of what you can hear weeknights starting at 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, we did it. Got there. Awesome.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone. Up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.